Hello and welcome once again to this series of podcasts brought to you in association with Kilkenny Library Services and the Government's Decade of Centenaries Fund through Kilkenny County Council. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and in these podcasts we examine different aspects of Kilkenny's revolutionary era history. In today's podcast, we will take a look at the reaction to the treaty in County Kilkenny, or to give the treaty its correct title, the Articles of Agreement for a Treaty between Great Britain and Ireland. But first, before we look specifically at Kilkenny, we might just have a quick overview of how the treaty came about and the myths that have built up around us during the intervening decades. As you might know, the famous or infamous treaty, depending on your viewpoint, was signed by the Irish and British negotiators in the early hours of Tuesday, the 6th of December 1921. As we have now passed the centenary milestone of that momentous event in Irish history, we will hopefully put to rest some of the myths that have grown up. Probably the biggest fable or bit of faux history which has come down through the decades is that the treaty caused partition. This, however, was not the case, as the state of Northern Ireland had been set up a few months previously, following the May 1921 elections. The Northern Ireland Parliament had even been opened by the King in June 1921, but it could be argued that the treaty cemented the border from the viewpoint of the 26 counties. The man who had been installed as the first Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, that's James Craig, did not want any direct involvement in the negotiations with the Southern Irish contingent in London, although he was kept abreast of it by the UK PM, that being David Lloyd George. Craig was relatively satisfied with the position of his new state, and what he had he'd hold. Indeed, from the perspective of the British government, they had been grappling with the question of Ulster for over a decade at this point, notwithstanding the fact that three counties of Ulster were not included, even though it was still referred to as Ulster. This focus on the Irish question was especially intense since the Third Home Rule Act of 1912, but by mid-1921, the British government now finally believed they had squared that Ulster circle with partition, the solution in inverted commas. As we all know how that solution turned out in the intervening decades. So now that the northern six counties had been partitioned into its own microstate with its own parliament, the British government could then focus on arranging a truce with the IRA in Sinn Féin to sort out once and for all the remaining 26 county bloc, so to finally get the Irish question off their table. Indeed, the war in Ireland was costing the British Exchequer more than £25 million a year to finance by this stage, so they were looking for a way out. That was an awful lot of money at that time. A truce was then eventually agreed to and came into effect on Monday the 11th of July 1921, as you know, just 3 weeks after the Belfast Parliament was established. Now, I have purposely put the situation from the perspective of the British government in the last few sentences just to highlight that Ireland was just one of many issues faced by that government. They had many more problems besides Ireland, from the struggling national economy in Britain itself to the troubles in their territories in India and Palestine. In other words, the suffering and trauma that the Irish people were suffering was regularly down their list of priorities. But with the truce and the subsequent negotiations, Ireland did now move centre stage. The other story everyone seems to know about the treaty talks regards the controversy about the negotiating team that was sent to London in October 1921. Now, I do guided tours in Dublin, and if I had a euro for every time someone said to me, Dev should have gone, or Dev knew Collins couldn't get the Republic, so sent him over to fail, I'd be a very rich man altogether. Although nearly cliché at this stage, there is only elements of truth in this. Indeed, I think we focus way too much on the Dev versus Collins drama over the treaty, which has been hyped up over the decades. And maybe films like Michael Collins, although a good dramatic film, kind of played into that because the negotiations of the treaty are just completely skipped over. We must remember it wasn't Collins versus Dev, but the Irish versus the British government negotiating team, not forgetting all the machinations and agendas the British were involved in on their side of the Irish Sea. It's sometimes forgotten that at this time both Collins and Dev were on the same side and indeed had much respect for each other and got on fairly well. I think the focus this centenary should be on the different players in the negotiations to understand how things played out vis-a-vis the Irish team led by Griffiths and also including Michael Collins, Eamon Duggan, Barton and Gavin Duffy AL and all their assistants versus the British negotiators, which included Lloyd George, Chamberlain, Birkenhead and of course Winston Churchill, along with some on the ground help from Dublin Castle men. And you also had a third party at the periphery of the talks, that being the new Northern Ireland government, who were kept abreast of developments without being directly involved. Now, in regards to De Valera not going to the treaty talks, it should be noted he had actually gone to London. This was immediately after the truce was declared in July 1921. He even had had four meetings with Prime Minister Lloyd George, a big development considering he was a wanted man just a few months before, the head of a murder gang, as the British press often referred to Sinn Féin as. Perhaps more importantly, these Downing Street meetings was a public acceptance of the legitimacy of De Valera and by extension Dáil Éireann in representing the Irish people. These talks in London in July were, however, more or less just talks about having talks. PM Lloyd George, the political Welsh wizard who had recently been a key negotiator of the Versailles Treaty after the First World War, later said that negotiating with De Valera was like trying to pick up mercury with a fork, i.e., Dev was near impossible to nail down. This was high praise indeed, coming from someone like Lloyd George, known as a master of the art of politics. There was even a Kilkenny connection to De Valera's July trip to London, as he had to go at short notice. He and his group had no accommodation booked in London. They were afraid if they accepted the hospitality of the British and putting them up, they would be spied on. This predicament was solved by a Kilkenny native, Major Loftus of Mount Loftus near Sceacfhosgene Gore's Bridge, who put his home in London at De Valera's disposal so he could carry out his business. The small Irish delegation that travelled over, which included Arthur Griffiths and Count Plunkett, used Major Loftus's premises as a base during their time in London. Now, by the time October came around, the main negotiating team that went to London did not contain De Valera. Instead, the team was led by Arthur Griffiths, so it could be said that Ireland did not have its best player on the pitch. De Valera's reasoning for not going was that as the head of state of Britain wasn't doing the negotiations, i.e. that being the king, so De Valera, as head of state of Ireland, shouldn't be involved also. Now, with regards to the point about De Valera knowing there wasn't a republic on offer and so he set Griffith and Collins up to fail, this doesn't really hold up either. De Valera himself said a month before the negotiations started that he was not a doctrinaire republican, end quote. By agreeing to the talks in the first place, the status of the republic was actually being ceded, as made clear in a series of letters between Lloyd George and Dev in August, September 1921. So Dev was willing to compromise on the Republic, especially if it brought the Northern Ireland government under Dublin's remit instead of London's. Probably the best scenario from De Valera's perspective would have been for the negotiating team in London to do 95% of the heavy lifting work, say, the tedious meetings about administration and defence and the like, which did in the end actually nearly take 2 months to agree. Then, when the talks stalled towards the end and things looked like they would break down over the final stumbling blocks, Dev would arrive at the last minute to save the day, some would say on his white horse, with his compromised version of the treaty that he was willing to accept. Dev's version later became known as Document Number 2. This document intended to resolve the major stumbling block of the Crown, i.e., how Ireland would come under the Crown and into the Empire. The British side stated that Ireland had to be within the British Empire in some way or other, hence their offer of Dominion status, just like Canada's. Dev's version said Ireland could be associated with the British Empire, but not in the Empire. All this sounds very confusing, and believe me, it was. But the idea was that Ireland would be equal in terms of our standing with Britain, but with the King still titular head of the association between Ireland and the British Empire. This meant Ireland was out of the Empire, but associated with it. I don't fully get it either. This was going to be a non-runner for the British, for one reason probably because they couldn't understand this, but also because the Crown's position in any agreement was very important to them. They could not stand there being a republic, in whatever guise that meant, right next door to them, especially since they were trying to hold their authority over many other overseas colonies at this very time. Lloyd George was also under much political pressure at home. The Conservative Party in Britain were furious that he was even negotiating with these murderers, so he was not going to play into their hands by allowing Ireland to leave the Empire. He wasn't going to concede that much. But even say in a parallel universe, if Dev's document number two was accepted by the British, there would still have been some ardent Republicans who would not have accepted any dilution of the Republic, and the Civil War would have gone ahead with or without De Valera, although of course it would have had much less sway without him being the political face of the anti-treaty element. Now, besides the crown, the other main issues for the British, as had been the case for centuries, one could argue, was the defence of the island of Britain, especially by sea. How was that to work in this new free state? Hence, what was known as the treaty ports were part of the treaty agreement. Tariffs and freedom to set customs were issues close to Arthur Griffith's heart to make Ireland economically independent, and he had wins on them. Even things like access to the telegram telephone network that came across the Atlantic Ocean by cable and into Valentia Island was important. The British government wanted guarantees around access to these lines of communication. But anyway, whatever agreement was reached, the cabinets in Dublin, which included Dev and Kilkenny, TD, W.T. Cosgrave, believed the negotiators would bring back the treaty to Dublin before it was signed. This didn't happen in the end, and there has been endless debates about the extent of the powers granted to the negotiators, or the plenipotentiaries, to give them the correct title. But it should be noted that the bones of what became the final treaty were actually brought back to Dublin the previous weekend, just 2 days before the signing. That was on Saturday, the 3rd of December, where a long-heated cabinet meeting took place with Griffith and Collins in attendance in Dublin. But in the end, Lloyd George lost his patience. On the evening of Monday, the 5th of December, he threatened terrible and immediate war in Ireland within 3 days unless the treaty was signed that very night. He said he had two letters written out to Northern Ireland Prime Minister Craig, one stating talks had broken down and the truce was off, the other saying agreement had been reached. Which letter he sent was up to the Irish delegation. As we can only imagine now, the Irish delegation were under massive, massive pressure. Some commentators later said they should have called Lloyd George bluff in the war, but it was a difficult predicament that they found themselves in. So that gives us the general background to the treaty negotiations. In attempting to understand the fallout from it is important to recognise, as objectively as we possibly can, the various motives, aspirations and actions of both those for the treaty and those against it. The principal cause of the civil war that followed was not the six counties in Northern Ireland, as we have said, but instead was one of sovereignty, specifically the loss of the Republic, albeit this never was accepted as being in existence by the British in the first place, to be replaced by an Irish Free State, which was to be a dominion within the British Empire, meaning the monarch was still to be head of state, however ceremonial that role was to be. To add fuel to the fire, members of Dáil Éireann would be required to take an oath of fidelity to the reigning monarch in Britain. Indeed, Michael Collins believed he had achieved a small victory in the negotiations when he succeeded in watering down the final oath. Instead of an oath of allegiance to the monarch, there was firstly an oath of allegiance to the Constitution of the Irish Free State, with just a promise of fidelity to the monarch. Thus, the intricacies of language, and even where words were positioned in sentences, were of utmost importance. There were a myriad of reasons in choosing a particular side. Firstly, to outline generally the pro-treaty slash free state view, the terms of the treaty gave Ireland a measure of freedom unimaginable just a few years previously. The king as head of state wasn't going to make much of a difference to the ordinary people of Kilkenny, but what they could see on the ground was British soldiers leaving, the RSE being disbanded, and the internees freed. So that was a very tangible benefit of the treaty right at local level. From the anti-treaty perspective then, the Republic had been diluted and the Irish people were still to be subjects of a British monarch. Many of those who opposed the treaty had been IRA combatants or Cumann na mBan members who were at the forefront of the fighting during the War of Independence era. They had made many sacrifices in regard to their livelihoods, their family's health, their own health, even experiencing a friend or family member being killed, all for the cause of this Irish Republic. From their vantage point, all they had sacrificed was now diminished or tainted. But it should also be said that many remained fairly neutral in public anyway, and it's fair to say that by and large, the general public were supportive of the treaty if that guaranteed peace. How much of this was influenced by a fear of slipping back to war is difficult to gauge. In other words, whether they liked the agreement or not, anything was better than going back to the troubled days. So, As the Kilkenny populace arose from their slumber on the morning of Tuesday, the 6th of December 1921, news and rumour began to circulate that a deal had been reached in the early hours of the morning in London between the delegates representing Britain and Ireland. Telegrams first brought the news to Kilkenny, with late editions of Tuesday's newspapers confirming it. Although the detail of the treaty was not yet known, the news of a settlement brought relief and joy to many. The threat of hostilities resuming had been the major cause of worry, but with the signing of the treaty, this danger appeared to have dissipated. The effects of the treaty was felt on the ground nearly immediately in every parish around the county. Within a few days, it was confirmed that nearly all the political internees would be unconditionally released. The first large groups of freed prisoners arrived in Kilkenny on Friday evening, the 9th of December 1921, just 4 days after the treaty was signed. An initial group of Callan internees arrived in Kilkenny at around 3 p.m. on that Friday afternoon. They made a 3-hour trip from Portlaoise prison by charabanc and kind of an open-top bus, which was driven by Callan Cooperative Secretary James Lyons and was decked out for the occasion with Irish tricolours. They stopped in Kilkenny City for a number of hours, where they were greeted by an ever-expanding crowd and where they waited for some of their fellow internees to arrive down by train. The Kilkenny Journal described the scenes at Kilkenny train station that evening as such, quote, "On Friday night, Kilkenny City paid a fitting tribute to the patriotic men from our midst who have been held in British dungeons without charge or trial. The explosion of fog signals marked the arrival of the train. Touching scenes followed as men embraced dear ones whom they had not seen for so long, mothers and sisters whose duty had been to wait and watch. A large number of IRA volunteers formed into a processional order and marched to the parade in Kilkenny, headed by St. Patrick's Brass Band and the Kells Piper Band. There were scores of motor cars and buses." End quote. Amongst the released men were well-known Callan residents J.J. Dunn, Michael Shelley and Jim Ruin, the latter being the former OC of the 7th Battalion, who was arrested exactly 1 year prior after the capture of Ernie O'Malley's documents by auxiliaries. As the 28 men of the Callan contingent made their way towards their hometown later that evening, they were guided along the route by numerous bonfires lit in their honour. They were accorded an even greater welcome on arrival in Callan, as described by the Kilkenny people. Quote, "As was benefiting the occasion, the day, Friday the 9th of December, was observed as a general holiday in Callan, and all business houses were closed. Outstanding features of the demonstration in Callan were the display of banners inscribed with words of welcome, one that immediately caught the eye, bearing the motto, 'Welcome to the Felons of Our Land,' which spanned the streets at the Central Hotel. The Christian Brothers schools and residents, the Augustinian Convent, Mill Street and the convent at Bridge Street were prominent in the matter of decorations, the tricolour being much in evidence." End quote. It was a similar story in Thomastown, where all the shops closed to welcome home their interned citizens. The previous day, Thursday the 8th of December, the Holy Day, local Sinn Féin councillor Liam Forrestal became the first Kilkenny prisoner to arrive home and was the centre of his own personal party. A motor car with an accompanying IRA incumbent Amman Guard of Honour paraded him from the train station around the town. The following day, the four remaining Thomastown and Inistig internees, Tom Ryan, William Cottrell, William Lee and Patrick White, arrived home to similar festivities. The celebratory atmosphere also continued in Kilkenny City on Saturday the 10th of December with the return of more prisoners, including the former Kilkenny Brigade OC, Thomas Tracy. He had been arrested over a year previously and was imprisoned in Ballykinler internment camp in County Down, where he held the rank of prison commandant. Now, there was also tragedy amongst the joyous celebrations. Although a truce was in place and a treaty had been signed, Kilkenny IRA companies continued to meet regularly to drill and attend classes. Indeed, they were more organised now than they ever were. On the evening of the 9th of December, that Friday, just 3 days after the treaty had been signed, Michael Byrne of the 5th IRA Battalion was demonstrating how to use bombs, kind of like grenades, at his home in Kiltown, the Roar. Unexpectedly, one of the bombs exploded. Byrne was blown backwards and suffered dreadful burns. He also badly fractured his thigh bone in the blast. None of the others present suffered serious injuries. Byrne was quickly brought to New Ross Workhouse Hospital by a motor car, but he consequently died the following day. He was just 20 years old. His funeral service took place in the Roar on the 12th of December, with a large contingent of IRA incumbent Amman members from Kilkenny present. The funeral was described as the largest ever seen in the district. Now, it is accurate to state that the treaty was widely accepted across many cross-sections of the community in Kilkenny. Sinn Féin Mayor of Kilkenny, Peter Dalucri, said that the treaty would receive the endorsement of the Irish people and the Irish race. Other notable Kilkenny leaders in the fight against the Crown Forces, including current Brigade OC George O'Dwyer, supported the treaty. The Catholic Bishop of Ossory, Dr. Brownrigg, announced 3 days of Thanksgiving to be held in all parishes in the diocese, commencing on Thursday the 15th of December. In a letter read throughout the county at Sunday Mass on the 11th of December, he gave his approval of the bountiful deal reached in London. Understandably, from his viewpoint, there was only one being responsible for this outcome. Quote, "For the last 2 years, in the sad history of our country, calamities of a dreadful nature have forced us to go in prayer to God. At last, relief has come, and in a most remarkable way within the past week. We should now show our gratitude to Him who has prospered us in such a bountiful and unexpected way." End quote. The Church of Ireland Bishop of Ossory, Dr. Day, similarly accepted the terms of the treaty, while also indicating that some sacrifices would be required by his flock, some of whom were known unionists. Quote, "I think we have reason to be profoundly thankful. Of course, all are called on to make sacrifices, but I do feel that these terms are a basis on which a true and lasting settlement can be made." End quote. The terms of the treaty were published in all the local newspapers. There was very little negative reaction, with all three newspapers supporting the treaty. This was not unusual, as there were only a handful of newspapers in the whole country that were against this. The Kilkenny Journal stated the deal reached was honourable to both Ireland and Great Britain after the long struggle of bitterness and suffering stretching back throughout the past 7.5 centuries, end quote. Alluding to the events of the previous years that led to the current agreement, it noted, "The fight for freedom was not inspired by a hatred of England, but by a love of Ireland," end quote. There was also an acknowledgement that the joy felt by many would be tinged with sorrow for some who had lost loved ones during the previous 2 years of fighting. "There is no victory without suffering. This will be a happy Christmastide in Ireland, even though there may be some vacant places in many homes," end quote. E.T. Keane of the Kilkenny People was even more enthused than usual by the treaty deal. He declared, quote, "One of the greatest and most heroic fights for freedom ever put up in ancient or modern history by any small nation has ended in a victory as complete and as striking as any nation, great or small, has ever achieved. The treaty makes the Irish people masters in their own house. What is good enough for Mr. Arthur Griffith and Mr. Michael Collins is good enough for us. It may be that there are people who claim to be better Sinn Féiners than the founder of Sinn Féin, Griffiths, just as there may be people who claim to be more Catholic than the Pope, but we doubt the validity of their claim," end quote. The Kilkenny Moderator newspaper, which traditionally had a large unionist and conservative readership, was mainly supportive of the terms of the treaty, as the only real alternative was return to the fighting. They had long since given up on the idea that society in Ireland would revert back to pre-1914 times, or, as historian Roy Foster puts it, Southern Unionists had long forecast their eventual abandonment by the British government, as they saw it. End quote. This is true of Kilkenny, where in 1914, 300 Unionists turned up at Kilkenny Castle for a major anti-Home Rule meeting. The Moderator did issue words of caution on the question of Ulster, however, something which was generally ignored by other publications. Although, as we said, the Northern Ireland State and Parliament were already in existence by this stage, the Unionist population of Kilkenny were understandably worried of their fate, as they were now a very, very small minority within a proposed Free State. Many Southern Unionists expected, or perhaps hoped, Northern Ireland would eventually have to merge into the Free State so as to at least increase the Unionist minority. Quote, "We have not yet fully realised that the people of Ireland have stepped from the darkness into the sunshine. There seems to be but one fly in the ointment, the unity of Ireland. That Ulster, i.e. Northern Ireland, will come into the Free State now or later, we cannot doubt. If Ulster decides to maintain her present isolated position, she will have to consent to a new boundary line. She will pay her taxes to the Imperial Government and will doubtlessly remain boycotted by the rest of Ireland. It is only a matter of time until she rejoins the Free State. It is too early to indulge in wild enthusiasm. Much yet has to be done." End quote. Kilkenny County Council held their meeting about the treaty behind closed doors, obviously expecting some vigorous exchanges. The result of the meeting was a resolution requesting the local TDs to vote in favour of the treaty in Dáil Éireann. The resolution stated that the council could see no alternative to the ratification of the treaty but chaos, and was passed by 15 for with 1 against. The only dissenting voice was James Donovan of Thomastown District. Similarly, the South Kilkenny Sinn Féin executive voted overwhelmingly in favour of the treaty by 36 votes to 6 against. The North Kilkenny Sinn Féin executive, chaired by Sean Gibbons, met in the new year after the hostile treaty debates had commenced in Dáil Éireann. The executive voted unanimously in favour of the treaty, but the resolution they forwarded to the Dáil was cognizant of the storm clouds that were gathering. Quote, "Having in mind all the circumstances that led us to sign the treaty and the alternative in case of rejection, we, the North Kilkenny Sinn Féin, are of the opinion that while the treaty falls far short of satisfying Ireland's national demand, it secures for Ireland a large measure of freedom by which we believe the Irish people can gain full and complete independence." End quote. The matter of the treaty was considered of such importance that the Kilkenny Farmers Union broke with one of their cardinal principles of not getting involved in politics when they convened at Kilkenny Courthouse to discuss the agreement. This is like a precursor to the IFA. Following a debate in a very largely attended meeting, there was a show of hands, with the result that all persons voted in favour of the treaty. This was then communicated to Dáil Éireann. The large farmers' union had a membership of around 6,000 people in County Kilkenny at this time, very large organisation. Many of the individual farmer union clubs around the county, such as Gore's Bridge, Slieve Rue and Glenmore for instance, had also passed motions approving of the treaty. Similarly, the East Kilkenny Gaelic League branch, which took in the areas of Paulstown, Greignamana and Gore's Bridge, who were meeting for their AGM just before Christmas, encouraged the uptake of the Irish language, making the point that, quote, "In the new era of freedom, which we are now entering upon, the Irish language will hold a most important place, so no one who intends living in the country can afford to lose an opportunity of acquiring a knowledge of our language," end quote. A meeting of ex-British Army servicemen from Kilkenny met in City Hall, Kilkenny, in December 1921, the majority of which had fought in the First World War. Remember, over 3,000 Kilkenny men and women, or with an association with Kilkenny, had participated in that very war. The chairman, John O'Neill, encouraged the attendees to support the treaty, stating, "It is up to the ex-soldiers of Ireland who had fought for the freedom of small nations in the First World War to show their appreciation at being citizens of an Irish Free State and to feel jubilant with every other section of the community." End quote. Also quick off the mark was the Dublin Industrial Development Association, whose remit was to help and advertise Irish-made products nationally. It took out adverts in many local publications, including the Kilkenny ones. Basically, it was a Buy Irish listing. Irish producers of everything from shoes to chocolate to flour to plum puddings to Irish-made underwear were even advertised. Their December 1921 ad, which was published a week after the treaty was signed, included the following, quote, "Now that peace has come, it is the patriotic duty of every citizen to help to build up the industries of the Irish Free State. At the present time, there are more than 100,000 unemployed people in Ireland. Remember that every shilling and every penny spent in Irish-made goods helps to Irish homes and helps to make Ireland richer and more prosperous." End quote. On the 7th of January 1922, just a month after it was signed, the treaty was ratified by Dáil Éireann. At this time, the Carlow Kilkenny constituency was a four-seat constituency. All the four seats were held by Sinn Féin TDs who were elected unopposed the previous year. However, they were divided on the treaty, with two voting in favour and two voting against. The two who voted for the treaty were W.T. Cosgrave, the Minister for Local Government, who would go on to become the President of the Irish Free State Government after the death of Collins. And the other was Garrod O'Sullivan, who was originally from Cork and actually a cousin of Michael Collins, but who had also connections to Carlow as he was a former teacher of Knockbeg College there. The local TDs who voted against the treaty were James Lennon from Boris County Carlow and Ned Ellsworth from Callan, OC of the famed 7th Kilkenny IRA Battalion at the time of the truce, and who was involved in many of the altercations, including Nine Mile House, Garry Ricken, Knocknagress, and the Monarch ambushes. The two TDs in favour of the treaty clashed fiercely with those two that opposed the treaty. James Lennon acknowledged he had received numerous resolutions from various Carlow and Kilkenny organisations urging him to vote in favour of the treaty, but he would not do so, stating in the Dáil that, quote, I will not vote or cast my vote to bring the citizens of the Irish Republic into the British Empire. I went forward as a Republican in 1918, I was elected as a Republican in 1921, and yet there are people here who say the Republic is dead. I hold the Republic is not dead, but I hold that the Republic never got right into its stride into the hearts of the Irish people. The people looked to the Republic for guidance and for assistance, and I consider that if I vote for the ratification of this treaty, that my life for the past 3 years would have been an absolute negation and an absolute lie. End quote. Ned Elward's contribution was of a similar opinion to Lennon's. Quote, I was elected by the people of South Kilkenny, and the people who elected me know what views I had, because at that time I was fighting in the IRA for the realisation of those views. Should my constituents change their mind, then they can remove me at the next election and put in a politician. Here, Elward sees himself as a fighter, an IRA man, and not a politician. But they cannot change my personal opinion or my principles. If their willingness to become British subjects, with a British Governor General to look after them and to take their allegiance to the British government and all that, if that is not compromise, I don't know what compromise is. Not only do they become British subjects, but they take an oath to a British king. I did not take it that the Republic had been let down at any time until I saw the terms of the treaty in the press. But the Republican ideal has not died, nor will it die, even though there be but 50 men in Ireland to carry us on. End quote. In another controversial speech, Deputy Garrod O'Sullivan strongly rebutted those against the treaty, saying, quote, I am anxious, not only for the good of Ireland, but for the good of the whole human race, that this strife should cease. And I would like to draw your attention to the effect of Gaelic culture and Gaelic civilization on the world. What has it done? The greatest anglicisers of the world have been the Irish. We, the Irish people, have been empire builders for England all over the world. We have built our railways and our roads. We have shot down troops who attempted to secure freedom from that empire. The reason I give for supporting the ratification of the treaty is that I believe it is the wish of the people who sent me here that I should support it. End quote. W.T. Cosgrave's contribution stuck to the wording and meaning of the actual treaty text, especially the much-debated oath. Quote, we have been listening for some days to various and varying opinions, legal opinions I should say, from both sides of the house as to what this means or what that means, and latterly these opinions have been centering around the relative distinctions as between faithfulness and allegiance. And we have learned today that faithfulness is from a slave to a master, and that allegiance is only from a subject to a king. This is not the interpretation the man in the street puts upon us, and is not my interpretation. A doctor of divinity, in explaining this matter to me in connection with the oath, points out that one can be faithful to and equal to. And it is in this sense that I interpret the oath. We were told that we did not make it plain at the elections that we stood for Dominion Home Rule. Was it made plain to the people that we were standing for association, either external or internal? Did anybody stand up before any audience in Ireland and say, I am standing for association with the Commonwealth of Nations? End quote. Now, of course, we don't have a figure of what percentage of Kilkenny citizens agreed or disagreed with the treaty. The treaty itself, of course, was never put to the people in a vote, but we can make some assumptions by examining the attitudes of the different clubs and societies around the county, some of which we've heard from already. It is fair to say then that the majority of Kilkenny citizens were undoubtedly in favour of the treaty. This is not surprising. As we said before, the fear of returning to the turmoil of war against the Crown forces was a major factor in the treaty's general acceptance. Furthermore, since the truce had come into effect back in July, the people of Kilkenny had experienced a life largely unhindered by British rule. This trial run, so to speak, of self-governance, although less than 6 months in existence, had not seen a descent into anarchy that some had predicted. For the majority, life continued relatively unchanged. For others who were active in the War of Independence years, their exploits and sacrifices had thrust them into positions of authority, while in addition they had also become highly regarded members of their local communities. As the treaty bestowed wide-ranging powers to an Irish government, many now were satisfied to work along democratic lines in developing the fledgling Free State, and were therefore not overly perturbed whether it was termed a Free State or a Republic. But not all veterans of the War of Independence era were of the same opinion, however, and they would make their feelings known in the coming months. But that, as they say, is a story for another day. Just to wrap up, as is still the case today sometimes, although there can be a big news story on the national scale, it is often the local issues that are more important to people, which are often overlooked then when we're looking back on history. One Callan resident wrote anonymously to the Kilkenny people in the lead up to Christmas with the following sad tale. It is a story far removed from the dramas of London and the Dáil. Quote, "There is today a feeling of rejoicing everywhere because, number one, that peace is at hand. Number two, that we have our brave men home again who sacrificed so much. And number three, that the happy season of Christmas is just upon us. But we can't forget the poor and destitute who have neither fire nor clothing or food. I have visited some of the respectable poor and was shocked and pained beyond words. Some with families of small children, practically naked, therefore suffering intensely from the cold and no nourishing food. In some cases, rain was coming down on their beds. There are also poor old men and women crippled from rheumatism and obliged to actually crawl out in the rain and cold to gather a few wet sticks, some of them without even boots. They are too decent to beg. Now, we all know that the ladies of Cumann na mBan collected money and contributed various comforts for the prisoners. May I suggest that there be a committee formed to collect for the poor of Callan? Coming up to Christmas, one thinks of the money spent on chocolates, cigarettes and alcohol. One must feel ashamed." End quote. Now, that concludes our story today, and it also concludes our centenary podcast for the year 1921. Thank you so much again for listening, and please keep supporting your local library. Until next time, goodbye.